Really, it's not a story about a company that's breaking the rules. It's a story about the rules are kind of broken.
A reporter investigates billions of dollars in internet subsidies to Alaska telecoms. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 26th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Anchorage reports a significant drop in the number of people sleeping outside.
This is good news, but the problem is not solved and there is still more work to do.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. State lawmakers passed two bills on the last day of the legislative session aimed at fulfilling requirements of a federal health care expansion effort. One of those, House Bill 110, would make it easier for out-of-state doctors, physician assistants, psychologists, social workers, and EMS personnel to get licensed in Alaska by joining what are known as interstate compacts. The Department of Health told federal officials in its application for a share of the $50 billion in funding from the Rural Health Transformation Program that Alaska would join the various compacts. Alaska is on track to receive more than $1 billion from the program. Anchorage Democratic Senator Forrest Dunbar says that's the primary reason for joining the compacts.
This is the Rural Health Transformation Program bill. That's why these compacts are being done, because the administration committed to the federal government that we would pass or attempt to pass a number of these compacts.
The bill passed unanimously in the state house, but there was more controversy in the Senate. The bill passed 13-7 in the upper chamber, and in a rarity, all of the no votes came from members of the bipartisan majority. Joining a compact means subscribing to a shared set of rules for doctors, EMS providers, and so on. Anchorage Republican Senator Kathy Geisel, a nurse practitioner and the Senate's number two leader, said Alaska is a unique place and should be able to impose its own rules.
I don't want to give up that authority to look at these medical professions and what they can do in our state. We are the only ones who care about and understand our state's needs.
The bill would not have the state join an interstate compact for nurses. That compact faces much stiffer opposition, including from the state's largest nursing union. The legislation now heads to Governor Mike Dunleavy. His office declined to say whether he'd sign them. Alaska telecommunications companies have taken about $4.6 billion in subsidies from the Federal Communications Commission over the past decade to help connect Alaskans to high-speed internet. And yet, according to a recent story by Anchorage Daily News and ProPublica reporter Kyle Hopkins, Alaska's land-based internet is among the slowest in the nation, and it's relatively expensive. The subsidies come from a fee on every American's phone bill, sometimes called a universal connectivity charge. So, given that we're all paying for the billions that have flowed to Alaska, Hopkins wanted to answer a specific question. What are we getting for all that money?
There's kind of a new gold rush that's been happening in Alaska, like, you know, right in front of us for a decade or two. You know, if you're a company that wants to make a lot of money, one way to do it is to sell internet, because there's a fire hose of federal money that's pointed at the state, you know, so people, they get out their buckets and they start collecting that money. And it's for something that, like, you know, at this point is a necessity. It wasn't cost effective for companies to lay fiber optic cable lines out to a village across a bunch of rivers and stuff. And so it had to be subsidized. The reporting that we're doing is exploring this idea of, okay, so 30 years ago, this promise was made that all these billions of dollars that are flowing to Alaska, that they would be used to provide Alaskans with, you know, some decent internet. So how are we doing? And where did that money go? Who got that money?
You found a guy who, he gets from the federal government $1 million plus a year to run a company that provides internet to a certain number of people, like north of Fairbanks. And I thought it was a really interesting story. It's how your piece starts out. And I wondered, could you tell me about that in particular?
A lot of us are familiar with GCI. That's the biggest telecom company in Alaska. They get the most of it. But there are like a dozen other companies around Alaska that also get these subsidies. I'm just, you know, looking at, okay, who owns the company? And I think in this case, I just Googled the name of the owner. And the first thing that came up was a Department of Justice, like a federal U.S. Department of Justice press release announcing that he had been convicted of tax evasion. And I thought, well, surely that's not the same person, you know, who's also on the board of directors for the Alaska Telecom Association, and who the Alaska Telecom Association, when they went to the legislature to argue that their industry is overregulated, held this guy up as their poster child.
And I mean, just an example, and like you said, I mean, compared to like GCI, a smaller company, but there were some questions around like how much money he was getting and how many homes were actually being serviced with internet through what it's Summit, I think is the name of the company.
Yeah, the name of the company that we wrote about was Summit, but really it's not a story about a company that's breaking the rules. It's a story about the rules are kind of broken, right? Because he's not, you know, we talked to a former FCC official who said, look, if you get the subsidy, at least the way that it's written for like Alaska companies and this particular subsidy that this particular company is getting, they get the money for like hooking up buildings to internet. And then whether or not anyone actually uses that internet or even wants it, it kind of doesn't matter. They're going to keep getting the money year after year. So you could have, like we gave the example of ADAC, you know, there's a telecom in ADAC. There's a lot of empty buildings on ADAC. They're hooked up to internet, nobody in them, but we all are still paying to subsidize that internet. And so the point of the story was this idea that this money is being spent in a way that in 2026 raises a lot of questions about if this is the right way to be spending public money and getting people internet.
If Alaska's gotten all that money, we must be getting pretty good internet, right? At a good price or no?
Well, it, you know, if you ask that question of the Telecom Association, they would say, you know what? We've made a lot of progress, you know, that compared to 5 years ago, Alaskans do have better internet. But by any benchmark, when you don't compare us just to ourselves, when you look at what the rest of the country has, we are, you know, we're dead last by pretty much every benchmark. You know, we're paying the most for the slowest internet. And, you know, that's the price of being an Alaskan, right? It's like, you know, we don't get the same infrastructure as other places. But that doesn't excuse this idea that, like, let's just accept all this money and never look at how it's being spent.
That was Kyle Hopkins, a reporter with the Anchorage Daily News and ProPublica. You can find his full story about FCC subsidies for Alaska Internet and a link to a survey about your own experience with Alaska Internet companies at ADN.com. As the Arctic takes on greater geopolitical significance, Alaska has assets of interest to the U.S. military. One is the cold climate, allowing troops to train for the possibility of Arctic warfare. Army Captain Trung Duan Vo led soldiers in a February exercise at the Yukon Training Center in Interior, Alaska. He says he saw how fatigue and low morale sets in much more quickly in severe cold.
I had to change my leadership style to meet that kind of quickness to how fast this environment can change your mental state of mind.
Vo spoke to Talk of Alaska host Lori Townsend for today's show on Arctic security. Another Alaska asset raised during the show was the location of the ADAC military base in the Aleutian Islands. The Naval Air Facility was closed in the 1990s, but its position within reach of Asian shipping routes and the Bering Sea is of renewed interest. In last year's Republican reconciliation bill, Congress approved $115 million for ADAC. Retired two-star General Randy Key, director of the Ted Stevens Center for Arctic Security Studies, says that just turns on the lights and pays for scoping studies.
There is the basic runway infrastructure, but you need hangar space. You need to revitalize the fuel areas. Essentially, the logistics that enable airplane operations, that actually has got to pretty much go back to ground zero and build up.
On Talk of Alaska, Key avoided talking about politics or criticizing President Trump's rhetorical moves on Greenland. Trump's repeated assertions that Greenland must come under U.S. control rattled Arctic and European allies. Key says he's focused on policy and education to ensure that the U.S. and allies are prepared to defend their northern flank. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Nome tries out a bike bus to get kids to school.
We don't have sidewalks, we don't have bike paths, we got muskox, you know, like there's not a lot of room for vehicles and students.
That's ahead, stay with us. Alaska state troopers have identified the man North Slope Borough Police shot and killed in Utqiagvik on Saturday as 46-year-old Gordon Kilbear Jr. Alaska State Troopers said in a statement that two officers with the North Slope Borough Police Department, Sergeant Riley Week and Officer Christopher Green, responded to a domestic violence call a block away from the top of the World Hotel around 4 p.m. They said Kilbear came out of a residence with a knife and both officers shot him with their handguns. Troopers said Kilbear was transported to the hospital but died from injuries. They said Kilbear's next of kin have been notified and his body is at the state medical examiner's office. They said one of the officers was also slightly injured from a knife during the incident. Troopers said the Alaska Bureau of Investigation is investigating the incident. They said once their investigation is complete, it will be reviewed by the Alaska Office of Special Prosecutions. North Slope Borough spokeswoman Angela Cox said in a text message that the officers were placed on leave. She said local police have turned the body camera footage over to the troopers for their investigation. The number of homeless people sleeping outdoors in Anchorage dropped significantly this year. That's according to the annual point-in-time count, a study that attempts to count every unhoused person across the United States on a single night in January. Anchorage Mayor Suzanne LaFrance says her team has been focused on reducing the number of people who are unsheltered. At a Homeless and Housing Committee meeting last week, she celebrated the 28% drop.
That is fewer people sleeping in our public spaces, fewer people susceptible to our cold winter nights, and fewer people unsafe in our community. This is good news, but the problem is not solved and there is still more work to do.
The overall number of homeless people in the city has also decreased, although less dramatically, down 6% from last year. In 2025, the municipality cleared homeless camps and passed a new law that makes it a crime to camp in some areas of the city. The city expanded outreach, added crisis response staff, and opened a new homeless shelter, increasing the number of year-round beds. The Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness conducts the annual count, during which outreach workers ask people why they're sleeping outdoors. The majority said they would have gone to shelter had there been beds available. Jessica Parks is with the coalition and says the shelters were full on the night of the count, which was true almost all winter long.
I think we have done a much better job with our coordinated outreach, making sure that when we have beds available, we are very quickly getting people who want those beds into them.
Parks says the fact that the shelters were full is a result of increased communication and collaboration between shelters and other organizations. A Canadian mining company wants to reopen a gold mine in British Columbia upstream from the Taku River, Southeast Alaska's most productive salmon stream. As KTOO's Alex Solomon reports, some Alaskans are concerned about the potential for pollution, but the mining company says there will be safeguards in place.
Canagold Resources, the company proposing to open the new Polaris gold mine on the Tulsiqua River in British Columbia, says it's taking steps to protect the environment. The Tulsiqua is a tributary of the Taku River in Alaska, which is known as the most productive salmon stream in Southeast. All five Pacific salmon species spawn in the river, including the largest Chinook run in the region. And although there hasn't been a concerted effort to study whether mining has affected Taku River salmon, some are concerned it could. Chris Farness is the Senior Vice President of Sustainability and Permitting at Canagold. He says the company plans to operate in ways that avoid harming the watershed and the fish in it. For instance, he said Canagold originally planned to use cyanide to separate gold on site.
But, you know, in consideration of the fisheries values and water quality values and things like that, we decided against that.
Instead, Farness says they'll use another method to concentrate gold that involves less chemical processing. To rebuild the site, which was formerly called the Polaris Taku Mine, Canagold expects to dig out and move the old tailings near Whitewater Creek, a salmon spawning ground connected to the Tulsiqua River. The excavation must be done carefully to avoid mobilizing pollutants or disturbing the creek.
Protecting Whitewater Creek, that's definitely, you know, that's what's going to make our mine very unique, is having a salmon-bearing stream right in the middle of the mine site.
Fish in Whitewater Creek have likely been exposed to contaminants from past mining activities. Dolly Varden collected in Whitewater Creek in 2018 and 2019 had greater concentrations of arsenic, cadmium, lead, and mercury than fish sampled downstream in the Tulsiqua River. That's according to data compiled in 2021 as part of a joint sampling program between Alaska and British Columbia. Farness says citizens from the Taku River Tlingit First Nation will monitor the environmental status of the operation. In 2023, Canagold signed an agreement that the mine won't move forward without the consent of the First Nation. At a recent House State Affairs Committee hearing on transboundary mining, some Alaskans voiced concerns over a lack of engagement with people on the U.S. side of the border and fears that potential pollution could affect salmon. Paulette Moreno is vice president of Tlingit and Haida. She said the state of Alaska must work with tribes to monitor and restore transboundary rivers.
Anything less is not under control. It is a failure to act in the face of known risk to some of the most productive salmon rivers in the world and the indigenous communities that depend on them.
Many concerns stem from decades of inaction on the Tulskwa Chief Mine. That mine was abandoned in 1957 and has been visibly polluting the watershed on the Canada side of the border since. That's just across the river from the New Polaris site. Doug Vincent Lang is the commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and participates in biannual transboundary watershed meetings with officials in British Columbia. He says that mining pollution on the Tulskwa River hasn't reached Alaska.
We've never found violations of water quality on our side of the border from DEC's water quality sampling, and we've never seen contamination in fish on our side of the border. But one of the questions we always get asked is, what is the baseline?
Patrick Moran is a biologist who manages the Alaska Transboundary Rivers Monitoring Program at the U.S. Geological Survey. He says more work still needs to be done to distinguish sources of metal contamination, since the watershed is known to have some naturally occurring metals.
The question everybody really wants to know is what contributions are coming from the mine and what contributions are just coming from naturally elevated background.
He says metals generally don't break down in the environment. Instead, they accumulate. According to data collected in 2018 as part of the joint sampling program, Taku River sediments tested in Alaska exceeded NOAA guidelines for arsenic, copper, and nickel. Although salmon don't spend their whole lives in the river, Moran says they're there at a sensitive time in their life cycle.
Juvenile fish rearing in the rivers are still very vulnerable, and it is something that we ought to be paying attention to.
But there hasn't been a concerted effort to study the effect of mining on Pacific salmon in the Taku River specifically. In Juneau, I'm Alex Solomon.
Alaska is a birder's paradise, and there's a new online resource highlighting prime viewing spots in the state's largest city. The Anchorage Birding Trail features 35 locations in and around the municipality, from Eagle River to Whittier. Hundreds of thousands of people flock to Alaska to bird each year, commonly traveling to hubs like Nome, Denali National Park, and the Kenai Peninsula. But Anchorage is also a birding hotspot, says Lauren Cusimano, communications manager for Audubon Alaska.
We have a whole lot of species that are present in town, and so we're trying to demonstrate Anchorage as a cool place to bird and make this trail something of a community asset for Anchorage residents and visitors.
Nearly 300 bird species have been recorded in Anchorage, according to the nonprofit. The online map highlights popular locations like Westchester and West Anchorage and Potter Marsh along the Seward Highway. The trail also includes less-known birding spots like Hillside Park and Cheney Lake in East Anchorage, which was named the 2026 Park of the Year by the Anchorage Park Foundation. Cusimano lives nearby and calls Cheney a sleeper site.
Cheney Lake is more or less like a neighborhood massive pond. You know, it's a lake. There are tons of redneck grebes. There are tons of waterfowl coming through, bald eagle, raven, songbirds.
There's a ribbon-cutting ceremony for the new trail at Westchester Lagoon on Wednesday at 5 p.m., followed by a bird walk. Bird checklist brochures will also be available. Marine heat waves have become increasingly commonplace in Alaska since 2014, and according to oceanographers, a series of different factors could make this summer especially warm. KMXT's Catherine Irving reports.
Marine heat waves can wreak all sorts of havoc in Alaska. Last year, a marine heat wave in the North Pacific Ocean fueled Typhoon Halong, which devastated Alaskan communities. This summer, there could be an extra hiccup. A strong El Niño event is likely, according to the World Meteorological Organization, which can make the effects of a heat wave even worse. El Niño events happen as a result of slower trade winds along the equator, which slows down the upwelling of cold water from deep in the ocean and causes overall warmer water conditions. Here's Alaska Fisheries Science Center Director Bob Foy speaking about it during a commercial fisheries trade show in Kodiak last month.
We're expecting a massive El Nino this year, and it is supposed to be larger than usual. It's going to make its way to Alaska. We'll probably see effects of it this summer.
Marine heat waves happen when the temperature of the ocean is 4 to 5 degrees higher than the baseline average for that area. According to research from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, temperatures in the Gulf of Alaska have been generally trending upwards over the past 50 years. But marine heat waves across the Pacific have hit even higher temperatures and have become more frequent since the mid-2010s.
Recent ones have elevated temperatures up to 8 degrees Fahrenheit over normal.
Rick Steiner is a former University of Alaska professor and current marine conservation biologist with his consulting business called Oasis Earth. He says that the combination of warming and increasing marine heat waves is worrying oceanographers.
There's a fear now in the physical oceanographic community that all of these ocean temperature elevation phenomena will eventually combine into a permanently warmer ocean system. So the shorter-term impacts will become permanent.
He says that because the ocean is normally so stable in temperature, even 1 degree of difference can have big impacts, especially on the cold-tolerant species that live in Alaska, like Pacific cod and snow crab. According to NOAA data, there has been a marine heat wave impacting the west coast of the lower 48 since the end of last year, and there's been one along the Aleutian Islands at the same time. Combined, Steiner says the El Nino and marine heat wave could create very dangerous conditions in Alaska waters in the coming months.
Unfortunately, every one of these marine ocean heat phenomenon amplifies each other. No one can predict with any degree of certainty that all of that will happen this summer in Alaska, but it's a possibility, and I believe looking at the trends and trajectories over the last few months, it's a probability.
The blob, which was a massive warming event that decimated sea life during the mid-2010s, also happened during a combined El Nino event and marine heat wave. Steiner says it's important that Alaskans keep an eye out for unusual things that are typically caused by marine heat waves, like dead seabirds or fish along the shore and emaciated marine mammals, and report any sightings to Fish and Game or NOAA. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Catherine Irving.
Riding a bike to school can be tough in Nome. The roads have tiny shoulders and only a handful have sidewalks. Last week, students tried a safer way to make the trip together. KNOM's Ben Townsend reports.
It's an overcast, windy day in Nome, but that isn't stopping Tessa Timbers Piana from taking part in the town's first bike bus.
We woke up early and had a big breakfast. I had eggs, bacon, and cinnamon and sugar toast.
Instead of piling into a yellow school bus, nearly 2 dozen students are riding their bikes. The route takes them from the rec center in town to Anvil City Science Academy, 4 miles to the north. ACSA parent Jeff Collins is leading the ride.
Nice job coming to the first bike bus. It's going to be hard because we're going to be going into the wind. I'm going to say that right away. We have to go over some things with safety, though.
Collins lays out the rules for today's ride, which includes several road crossings.
But when you hear one whistle blow, that'll be our go sign, okay? So when you hear, what do? Well, it's time to go, okay? When you hear, that's going to be stop.
Okay.
Ready?
ACSA Principal Emily Annis watches the group set off to the west with a smile plastered on her face.
I love our kids and I love our community, and I just want to do things that are like core memory events. And I hope for them this is a core memory event, because I know for me it will be.
Annis organized the ride after seeing a similar bike bus in Portland on social media. She admits Nome's looks a little different.
We don't have sidewalks, we don't have bike paths, we've got muskox, we don't have, really good shoulders. We have some shoulder to go over on, but in town, there's not a lot of room for vehicles and students.
You can't miss the mob of bikes. By riding together, it's easier for the drivers to spot them, which means it's safer. And for this first ride, a police car up front and fire truck in the back certainly helps too. Some bikes are in better shape than others. The group makes several stops to put chains back on gears and air up tires. They pause just once for a crash.
Oh, we have a crash. You all right, bud?
Okay.
Were you riding here? No hands again? Okay.
Nearly an hour and a half after starting, the group rounds the corner of campus to cheers and handmade signs of encouragement.
Yeah, don't run over people.
With just days left on the school calendar, Colin says the ride was a good test for future bike buses.
I mean, this is part of it, is building the culture around. And Nome's not really conducive to doing this. Laura and I bike these roads constantly. This is honestly the absolute safest ride I've ever been on.
In the afternoon, students will strap up their helmets for the ride home, hopefully with fewer scrapes along the way. In Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone and Alex Solomon in Juneau, Liz Ruskin, Aliona Niden, Hannah Floor, and Ava White in Anchorage, Catherine Irving in Kodiak, and Ben Townsend in Nome. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde, Annie Fite produced tonight's show, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.